The security lapses were fairly fundamental and also fairly long-standing.
The state pays a big settlement to the federal government for a patient privacy breach. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 26th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the team investigating the historic Glacier plane wreck is zeroing in on identifying the aircraft.
Some of the stuff was found in pretty surprisingly good condition. It was interesting to see.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
The state of Alaska has agreed to pay $1.7 million to the federal government for a 2009 security breach of patient data. A federal investigation following the breach found inferior security measures in place at the Alaska Division of Health and Human Services. The settlement under the patient privacy law, known as the HIPAA Act, is the second largest in history and the first against a state agency. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
In October 2009, a portable hard drive was stolen from the car of a computer technician who worked for the State Department of Health and Social Services. The hard drive may have contained patient data from the Office of Children's Services and Public Health, so the state was required to report its loss to the federal government. And the investigation that followed found big problems with security measures the state was taking to protect patient data.
The security lapses were fairly fundamental and also fairly long-standing.
Susan McAndrew is Deputy Director for Health Information Privacy with HHS. She says the investigation revealed a long list of shortcomings with the state's security procedures. She says the settlement amount is high because the list of infractions was so long.
The amount is reflective of the number of violations and the period of time over which they occurred.
The state of Alaska never determined whether there was, in fact, patient information on the hard drive. But Thor Ryan, chief security officer with the state of Alaska, says the state's policy is to err on the side of caution. And he says the timing of the incident was unfortunate.
Because we were partway through an encryption project to guard against just this kind of incident. Unfortunately, that particular drive had not been encrypted at the time it was stolen.
The state hasn't received any information from patients or law enforcement that anyone was impacted by the security breach. Ryan says after the incident, the department intensified its efforts to encrypt state computers and storage devices. He says the state also enhanced its security and privacy policies for employees.
And made numerous other improvements that weren't directly related to the theft to improve our security overall. So in short, it's improved a lot.
The only higher settlement amount over HIPAA Privacy Act violations was with CVS Pharmacy for $2.3 million in 2009. That case involved the improper disposal of patient information on prescription bottles. The Alaska case is the first settlement with a state. McAndrew says states are not entitled to preferential treatment when it comes to protecting patient privacy.
The rules apply equally to both public and private entities. The obligations are the same, and so our enforcement actions also need to be on the same footing.
McAndrew says the state was fully cooperative with the investigation. The state says it's already paid the settlement amount. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska Senator Mark Begich received a letter today from Air Force Chief of Staff General Norton Schwartz stating that the Air Force will not take action on the proposal to relocate the F-16 Aggressor Squadron from Eielson Air Force Base to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
Senator Begich released his comments about the letter he received from Air Force General Norton Schwartz in a five-minute YouTube video.
Well, I think it's a pretty significant letter, and it really sends a great message to our community of Fairbanks.
In the letter, General Schwartz says Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta has directed the Air Force to suspend all force structure changes until Congress completes action on the National Defense Authorization Act. It's a bill that appropriates funding for the military in fiscal year 2013. If the bill does not provide funding for the relocation, General Schwartz writes that it will not happen. Begich says the decision gives the community of Fairbanks a reprieve.
It gives us a chance to really understand what the consequences are of this. And I think once that's all laid out, the housing issues, the environmental impact, which now the military has agreed to do both these issues, as well as the other costs associated with this, this move makes no sense. And I think Fairbanks community knew this. The Pentagon just didn't know it.
The letter comes after a meeting between Senator Begich and General Schwartz in Washington, D.C. on Monday. As a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Senator Begich put a hold on the four-star promotion of Lieutenant General Herbert Hawk Carlisle until he received answers from the Air Force. Begich says the suspension of the move means he'll release the hold. Alaska's congressional delegation has argued against the relocation since it was announced in February. Begich continues to call the plan misguided. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Senator Begich wants to see for himself the damages stemming from the poor Chinook salmon run in western Alaska. Begich will be traveling to Bethel next week to host a roundtable discussion on July 2nd to get information from community leaders and fishery managers.
Obviously be there firsthand and see the impact on the Chinook salmon run for the YK district and get some feedback, but also tell them some of the things we're trying to do. We recognize there's some budgetary issues with regards to the management and with the subsistence board and some other items, so I want to kind of go through that with them.
Begich has also sent a letter to Interior Secretary Ken Salazar asking that the Interior Department draw back from proposed funding cuts that would impact the Alaska Subsistence Management Program. Begich points out in his letter that he doesn't believe Interior can meet the goals of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act or implement the recommendations of the department's review of the subsistence program without increased funding. A team of specialists have completed an investigation into a downed aircraft found earlier this month on the Colony Glacier in the Matanuska Valley. The Joint POW-MIA Accounting Command, based in Hawaii, sent a team to Alaska after Alaska National Guard members on a routine mission discovered the wreckage on June 10th. Captain Jamie Dobson is a public affairs officer for the JPAC.
We're not 100% sure at exactly what we recovered yet, but some of the material evidence recovered at the site we do believe currently correlates to a military aircraft from the 1950s.
Dobson says the team reached the site on June 18th, initially intending to examine the site to provide assessment for a follow-up recovery team, but the team realized they could manage the recovery and began immediately. Deteriorating environmental conditions were a factor in that decision. The team recovered materials, such as life support equipment from the antique wreckage and some bone fragments from the glacier.
There was some stuff found that we think will be very helpful in determining and correlating what we found at the site with known wreckages in the area. But yeah, some of the stuff was found in pretty surprisingly good condition. It was interesting to see.
The evidence will be transported to JPAC's Central Identification Laboratory in Hawaii for further analysis. Dobson says it is not known how long the lab work will take before positive identification is made. JPAC falls under the U.S. Pacific Command and works to search for the more than 83,000 Americans still missing from past conflicts. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the state celebrates a rare bit of good news on the obesity epidemic.
It's great that we saw the short-term decrease just in a few years.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation.
And by
ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The U.S. Department of Interior will release its five-year leasing plan for offshore drilling later this week, and Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar says it's highly likely Shell will receive permits to launch exploratory wells on the leases it already holds this summer. APRN's Peter Granitz reports.
While the plan won't come out for a few days, top brass at the Department of Interior held a conference call Tuesday to give a sneak peek. There will be two lease sales in the Arctic Ocean off of Alaska, one for the Chukchi Sea in 2016 and the other for the Beaufort Sea 1 year later. Those are both delayed 1 year from the plan released in November. And of course, there's this summer. Secretary of the Interior Kent Salazar says while his department is still reviewing Shell's permits, he's optimistic the company will pass. It's in the final review stages with the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement.
If Shell activities in the Arctic proceed this summer, BSEE will have an inspector on site 24 hours a day. Shell will also be required to have a full suite of response capabilities in the area, including capping, DAC, and a number of other containment programs and systems.
The company tested its capping stack in Puget Sound Monday, and Secretary Salazar says he's confident there will not be an oil spill in the Arctic. If he had concerns, he said he would not move forward. The Department of the Interior is touting its leasing programs as innovative. Officials are saying leases will be targeted and locally tailored. For a lease to be granted, Interior weighs the value of the resource, possible environmental harm, and local concerns. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Director Tommy Boudreau says that last reason is why there will not be drilling at one site off the North Slope near Barrow.
We have taken the step at this point of deferring and removing an area north of Barrow that we know is important to subsistence. This is consistent with the overall approach we'll be taking with the Arctic.
It's unclear whether industry was looking to drill in that specific site, though. The Department of Interior is extolling Arctic drilling as part of its all-of-the-above energy approach that includes renewable and traditional fuel sources. Perhaps to calm the concerns of some, Secretary Salazar says that there have been more than 30 wells drilled in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas already, and none has undergone the scrutiny that the current ones are receiving. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Powerful tides and currents have long made Cook Inlet a hot spot for studying tidal energy. As KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports, a new project recently launched in the inlet might bring the promise of tidal energy a few steps closer to reality.
Oceanographers with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration braved chilly, rainy weather at the Homer Harbor June 13th in order to put in place a new experiment, the installation of new current metering equipment that will hopefully tell them more about the potential for tidal power in Cook Inlet. Chris Holderreed is director for NOAA's Kositsna Bay Laboratory near Seldovia. She says the equipment is designed to measure the speed and direction of ocean currents. Unlike older current meters, the new ones use sound instead of a propeller to measure the speed of the water.
They're called acoustic Doppler current profilers. It's kind of a big name. But what they're using is the bouncing sound off particles in the water to get the speed and direction. And they sit on the bottom and look upward and bounce sound up into the particles in the water. And we get a measurement of the velocity every 5 meters. And then you can set it up to record as often as you want.
The instruments are called SUBS, short for Submerged Underwater Buoy System. They will be out in Cook Inlet for the next 2 months, says Holderreed, taking measurements of the speed and direction of the water from the seafloor all the way up to the surface. The subs really do look like subs, too. They are a pair of cylindrical, torpedo-like containers anchored to the seafloor by a railroad wheel. Both subs are about 3 feet long and contain glass balls inside their metal casings, which provides the buoyancy to hold them in one place so they don't move much with the current. An attached weather vane keeps them pointed in one direction. A total of 10 current meters have been installed throughout Cook Inlet, including 3 in the Ketchumak Bay area, 1 near Kalgan Island, 3 in the upper inlet near Nikiski, and 3 more near Fire Island off the coast of Anchorage. Holderreed calls Cook Inlet one of the best places in the world to study tidal energy.
For 2 reasons. 1, we have the currents, so you have the strong currents, and 2, they're near the power transmission grid. Here in Cook Inlet, all along the inlet, we have access to the grid and to strong currents.
This is not the first study of tidal power potential in Cook Inlet. Alaska Energy Authority and Ocean Renewable Power Corporation have conducted previous studies, but this one is the first to partner with NOAA and to use the new current meters. Holderreed expects NOAA to have a draft model of energy potential for the inlet completed by November of this year. That information will then be given to whoever wants to use it.
From that, they can figure out, okay, where is the best place? Where do we have the best energy? Where do we have the best currents located near the right infrastructure on land? So this is sort of that fundamental piece that you need to do everything else. And then it's actually going to be fun to see when folks take that and run with it to, you know, think about the right designs to put in the water.
Holder Reed says the information gathered by the new current meters could be useful beyond just the study of tidal power. For instance, an accurate model of water circulation in Cook Inlet and Ketchumack Bay could be important for studying ocean acidification or for improving oil spill response. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
A series of 10 public hearings on ballot measure 2 will be held around the state in July, starting next Monday in Soldotna and ending July 26th in Juneau. The Citizens Initiative would restore the Alaska Coastal Management Program, which state lawmakers failed to reauthorize during the 2011 regular and special sessions. It's the first measure to fall under a new state law requiring at least 8 public hearings on an initiative up to 30 days before election day. Anchorage Republican Representative Cherise Millett sponsored the law and says it's meant to provide a more transparent initiative process.
Initiatives are very powerful. They're more powerful than a law that any legislature can create. They last for 2 years. They can't be vetoed by the governor, and they can be amended, but in a very small amount.
Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell, whose office oversees state elections, says the public hearings will largely follow the format of a legislative meeting. His office held a press conference yesterday in Anchorage featuring representatives from the pro-Measure 2 Alaska Sea Party and the Vote No on 2 campaign. Sea Party co-chair Terza Tippin Poe says claims that local communities would have veto power over large development projects under the Measure 2 are simply untrue.
Coastal management does not stop development. It is a unifying force that resolves potential issues, making it easier to do business in Alaska.
But No on 2 spokesman Rick Rogers says the initiative is much broader and more complex than the coastal management program legislators failed to reauthorize last year. He said if the measure actually cut red tape and made it easier to do development, regulated businesses would be lining up to support it.
Ballot measure 2, a wholly new, complex, poorly conceived regulatory framework will hurt Alaska's economy and cost Alaskans jobs. My organization, the Resource Development Council, supports responsible, well-designed coastal zone management. Ballot Measure 2 is far from that.
The Federal Coastal Zone Management Act allows states that adopt an approved coastal management program to have greater input into development decisions along their coastlines. It also streamlines the regulatory processes of various local, state, and federal agencies. Alaska's program had been in place for 32 years prior to closing last year. Measure 2 will appear on the August 28th primary ballot.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
The wildfire burning off the park's highway near Anderson is slowing down as clouds move across the area. The Bear Creek Fire has burned 8,200 acres about 13 miles southwest of Anderson, an area where there are subdivisions and structures. State Fire Information Officer Pete Buist says firefighters are using the break in the weather to work the fire front.
It's a big old wind-driven fire that, you know, we just couldn't keep up with an initial attack. It made about a 3-mile run in less than an hour this afternoon and showed some really impressive fire behavior.
Over 300 people are working the Bear Creek Fire. The response ramped up yesterday with more crews, bulldozers, and a Type 1 management team. The Bear Creek Fire is the combination of wildfires started by lightning on Saturday that all burned together. The obesity epidemic among young people in America has been garnering national attention for the last decade. Experts blame sugary sodas and unhealthy snacks in schools, coupled with a decrease in exercise programs. And Alaska isn't immune to those problems. More than 3 out of 10 kids in the Anchorage School District are overweight. But for the first time in a decade, that number is declining. APRN's Wendy Jonathan reports.
The rate of obese or overweight children in the Anchorage school system dropped 2% this year, from 38% to 36%. While that might not seem like a significant decrease, 2% of the 40,000 children in Anchorage School District translates to several hundred healthier children. Carol Fink, program manager for the State of Alaska Obesity Prevention and Control Program, says the decrease is significant.
Weight changes very slowly, and we're looking at the long term when we're doing obesity prevention. So it's great that we saw the short-term decrease for just in a few years.
The state has been tracking trends in Alaska's school children since 1998. There was a 5% increase in obesity and overweight children until 2003, then the numbers plateaued for the next several years. Fink believes the recent decrease over the last year is due to the implementation of healthy lunch programs and an increase in physical education, from 60 minutes a week to 90 minutes. She also stresses that awareness is key.
I don't think that any one of those things by themselves could have made the difference, but we need that synergy of all the different policies and programs and practices changing together to make a difference.
A person's weight is not just an individual's problem. Fink argues that overweight children tend to have more health issues and spend a lot of time in the nurse's office or out of school. Being overweight can lead to social problems as well, which is distracting for a child in school.
There's a disparity there that kids who are overweight or obese don't get the same education as our kids that are healthy weight because they're not able to concentrate. They're not at school as often. And so it becomes a community issue. And then the bottom line is those overweight kids become overweight adults.
The 2% decrease was due to more than just the school district's efforts. Ed Graff, the assistant superintendent for curriculum for the Anchorage School District, believes that it's important for the entire community to be involved.
I just think it's an important cause, and it's one that extends well beyond the school environment, and we're one important piece to ensuring that we have our youth around for many, many years.
Healthcare providers and doctors across the country say that obesity and overweight issues results in health issues that cost the nation $460 million annually. In Alaska, the cost of treating obesity issues threatens to overwhelm the state's Medicaid and Medicare programs. Graff says these concerns are too large for children to understand.
So those are risks that I think we have an obligation not to put on our youth.
Graff hopes that with an increased awareness and community involvement, the obesity and overweight problem in the Anchorage School District can continue to decline over the next few years. In Anchorage, I'm Wendy Jonathan.
For many soldiers, the transition from military life to civilian life can be a challenging one. That change is often amplified by injuries sustained in combat, both physical and emotional. Even though the memories of those traumatic events will always be there, some soldiers are able to find solace in rehabilitation programs like Project Healing Waters. APRN's Josh Edge has the story.
Juan Aguilar is a veteran of 6 combat tours split between Iraq and Afghanistan. A bullet wound to the stomach during his final deployment in 2007 is what ultimately brought him back to the U.S., but it was the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder that had the biggest impact on his life. Juan suspects he had PTSD after his very first deployment to Afghanistan that started 3 weeks after the terrorist attack on 9/11. What he saw in combat shook him.
It's kind of a helpless feeling to see young kids die and not be able to help them. And I had one die in my arms. So, you know, it's pretty nerve-wracking. And it finally all hit me at once with the injuries and stuff like that. So the doctors diagnosed me with that. And then with the traumatic brain injury I had, it was more reason for them to not allow me to go back.
After the diagnosis was made, Juan cycled through a few different PTSD treatment programs. And they helped some, but he continued to struggle.
I thought I was alone with the problems that I had with the post-traumatic stress and how could this happen to me? I've always pictured myself as a tough infantry soldier. How could this be? How could this be?
But in 2009, Juan was introduced to Project Healing Waters while at the Puget Sound VA in Seattle. Not long after, he was attending fly tying and fly fishing classes in the newly created Alaska chapter of the program. Now, he's hooked. Some days, he might be at Green Lake trying to perfect his casting technique. Other days, you might find him sitting in the Soldier Family Assistance Center on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, tying flies to use on an upcoming fishing trip with a group of people who, not all that long ago, were complete strangers. That may have bothered him a couple years ago, but now he looks forward to it every week.
It just hit me, you know, it's like, wow, I actually enjoy doing that. And before, going to where there's a lot of people in an enclosed room, no, it's not a good thing for me. But it didn't seem to bother me. And I came in and walked around and I said, yeah, this is something I like.
The atmosphere at the fly tying class is very relaxed. Some people are getting instruction, while others might just show up to shoot the breeze. Mike Harsh is a board member of Alaska Fly Fishers, the sponsoring organization of Project Healing Waters in Alaska. He's been volunteering with the program for a few years.
It's just sitting down and talking about fly tying and, oh man, you should have seen the one that got away yesterday. And it really brings people kind of out of their shells. And, you know, and we have all good, pretty much good senses of humor around here. And I think that's infectious. I think they really relax around us.
The national program was established in 2005, but the Alaska chapter is in the middle of its third summer. It started out small, with only a handful of participants its first year. But Juan says it's been growing steadily each year, with about 50 participants now. The program also organizes fly fishing trips throughout the summer. Last year, Juan went on a trip to Kodiak, where he was able to catch every species of salmon in 1 week.
I'll never forget that trip. I mean, that's where it was a great trip. I had a blast, and the only worry I had was I had to leave in a week.
Juan says his life has improved since taking part in Project Healing Waters, and recommends it to any soldier who is looking for help.
There's so much to gain. There's not much you got to give. All you have to do is make the time available to come here and learn, and you can see how the healing process will take its own toll and start going into the right direction you need.
Since Project Healing Waters has had such a profound impact on Juan's life, he gives back as much as he can, with the hope that the program can help other soldiers and veterans make a smooth transition to civilian life. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
For pictures and more information about Project Healing Waters, go to alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Aaron Selbig in Homer, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., Josh Edge and Wendy Jonathan from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at alaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
You can find APRN headlines from around the state online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.